What the hell?
Hello, hello.
Welcome.
Welcome to Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping, the special quarantine episode. Holy shit, I think we're missing Drew. We're missing Delta Drew Pearson. We're doing a high school level three-way calling episode from because we're all quarantined in our respective dwellings like everyone else should be, I guess.
Speaking of which, did you see the other night, what's the guy, Jimmy Fallon from The Tonight Show? He's doing the at-home edition.
Is he really?
He's got his kids like climbing all over him the whole time. He's doing, like, you know, doing his wife's recording him on a video camera, and he's doing the monologue, you know, just like out by his front door.
Hey, perfect.
Yeah.
I fucking love it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to watch.
Well, I guess Drew will jump in whenever he gets here. I guess I can try to send it to him again and see if he can fucking get it, but
okay.
Anywho, so this week on the special quarantine episode, we are going to talk about, since we did Nirvana last week, so I guess we can kind of fall into the quote-unquote alt-grunge realm of the 90s again. We'll talk about another giant powerhouse band during that time, the Pearl Jam, if any of you guys have heard of them.
I've never heard of those guys. Are those guys any good?
Yeah, arguably one of the arguably the longest lasting American rock band in American history.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean. These guys have been around since. Oh, there's Drew.
What up,
Delta Drew?
Delta Drew Pearson. He's back. He's here. Well, he's not back. He's here now.
That's what I'm saying. I'm here.
We've gotten through the introductions, and we've announced that we're going to be talking about the Pearl Jam on the special quarantine episode.
So do we want to start on like where they picked up their name, or do you guys want to start with where the founding members came in? Like,
let's Mookie start Blaylock? With who they are. Mookie Blaylock.
Mookie Blaylock.
Well, let's start with who they are. Pearl Jam, rock band formed in the 90s. Specifically 1990 in Seattle, Washington. It was the predecessor love child of many different bands to follow from the main proponents of this band, Stone Gossard and Jeff Ament. Somebody's going to correct me on that. But Jeff Ament, the bass player, and Stone Gossard, the rhythm guitar player, they were kind of the founding fathers of this group, as well as, you know, bands like Green River and Mother Love Bone, right?
Oh, Jeff Ament was definitely the best, my favorite member of Pearl Jam.
Really? With his floppy hats?
Yeah. His little 90s necklaces he's always wearing.
Yeah, he's the stereotypical pinnacle of the 90s rock star, I think.
I think he is the poster child for the 90s.
I think so. I think so, too. So this is, you know, we're talking about, Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament. They're from the Washington, Seattle area. And they were in a band in the mid-1980s, a punk rock band, or quote-unquote grunge band, depending on what you would, you know, if you're into labels and shit, called Green River. And they had some divisions between their bandmates, Mark Arm and Steve Turner, and that kind of was the end of that. But that gave birth to the pre-Pearl Jam, the old Mother Love Bone.
Mm. Mother Love Bone.
That was a fucking great, great band for its great little band. Time, you know?
Oh yeah,
Andy Wood always their lead singer. He ended up dying of a heroin overdose, but he was always a very interesting character to me.
Yes, especially also that makes him interesting. Not really himself being, you know, personality wise, but he was roommates with Chris Cornell.
That's right.
And didn't they used to have competitions when they lived together? Like they said, every day. They would each record a song, a different song each day, and sometimes multiple songs. And then, they would say whose song is better each day. You know, I thought that was kind of good motivation for each other, I guess, to keep writing, you know, during those times.
Oh yeah. Chris Cornell and Andy Wood were best friends. Obviously they were roommates. They were, you know, not band buddies, but they were, you know, they were into the same things. And so they were all in the same culture. And so, yeah, they were best friends. I always thought that was a pretty interesting fact. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Andy Wood dying, that, you know, as tragic as it is, because they had just signed with PolyGram Records and they released their debut album in July of 90, Apple. And that was a pretty good album. Andy Wood, he wasn't, he was on the, you know, the budding exit of the kind of the hair metal thing, because Andy Wood was definitely a hair metal.
Yeah, show. Yeah, of course. Yeah, like if you see old videos of Mother Love Bone, you see him with the tight spandex pants and, you know, the long, you know, hairsprayed hair.
Yeah, he legitimately looks like he could be Bret Michaels' stunt double.
I was about to say the same right there.
From Sweden, you know?
Yeah, right.
And Andy, like, if you ever watch like interviews with Andy Wood or something, man, like, the guy was a born star. Like, he and the reason I'm going so far into Andy Wood is this is what budded. I think, you know, arguably Andy Wood dying sparked the grunge movement.
You're going far into Wood.
I think so. Well, far in, I'm going deep into Wood.
I'm not in the conversation.
Beavis.
Oh, yes, you
proxy.
Are.
No, yeah, not. By proxy, you are, good sir.
No way.
You're the mother. Yeah. You're the mother love bone.
Yeah, you're the mother love bone. You're
damn right. So, get it right.
Yeah. So Andy Wood dies of a heroin overdose 4 months after Apple's release. And, you know, Ament and Gossard kind of, you know, obviously that was they thought they were going to be huge. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they split off. Obviously, they broke up the band because I don't know. I like that they did that, and I like that Nirvana, you know, Dave, Pat, and Chris. I like that they, once their frontman died, and once the main songwriters died, that I love that they dropped the name and just went and did something else. Oh, I respect the fuck out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they had no choice.
Right. Like what Alice in Chains did after I can't get behind it, man. Like once your frontman and main songwriter dies, like your band's done.
What about AC/DC?
That's the only exception in history.
What about Van Halen?
Nah, I'm not a Van Hagar guy, man.
Yeah.
Well, dude, you guys are nuts, man.
Nah, man. David Lee Roth are bust.
Yep.
No absolutely. Way. No way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not a Van Hagar guy. I feel the same way about Black Sabbath, man. Dio's dope by himself, but if it ain't Ozzy, it ain't Sabbath, dude. Right?
Can't disagree.
That's where I'm at with it.
Okay,
once you lose.
So I like it when I liked Van Hagar because they didn't start, you know, doing all the David Lee Roth songs. They came up with their own stuff. That's you know, original. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they still made it through the barrier of you know, of still keeping their fan base and all that stuff. But
yeah.
then you have bands like Journey who replace their lead singer with a sound alike. That's kind of like, you know, it's cool, but it's not. That, you know, it's not the same thing. They're not doing original stuff. If they are, no one gives a shit.
I won't disagree there.
Yeah. So but anyway.
So I'm saying that, sorry, that there's two types, you know what I'm saying? Like the new Alice in Chains. The new Alice in Chains is kind of a third type though, I guess, because they're doing the old stuff. And they're doing new stuff, but
I don't like that when a you know, your main songwriter or your frontman, or, you know, it doesn't have to be your main songwriter or whatever, or the frontman. You could have somebody like when Neil Peart of Rush, he just died. If Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson just got some fucking Joey Jordison, the old drummer for Slipknot, to play for him, I'd be pissed. I'd be like, dude, you're not fucking Rush, quit.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It doesn't have to be the frontman. But so Ament and Gossard, devastated by the death of Andy Wood, they split off and they start, you know, they're continuing to write music, but they're looking for a new front man at this time. And so one of Stone Gossard's actually good friends, Jack Irons, who happened to be the drummer for Red Hot Chili Peppers at the time down in California.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knew this guy that he used to surf with and play basketball with that worked at a gas station named Eddie Vedder. And so Stone sent down a letter and a tape to give, you know, to see if he could help him out finding a singer. And Jack Irons gives it to Eddie Vedder. Eddie Vedder writes a couple of songs and sings over whatever they sent him. And one of those songs happened to be Alive, and sends it back to Stone. And a week later, Eddie Vedder's up there and he's in the band.
It's pretty amazing how that happened, isn't it? Also,
yeah.
Just out of curiosity, because I haven't, have you guys ever listened to anything from Bad Radio or Eddie Vedder's original band?
No.
Uh-uh. No.
Might be some homework for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's some homework for me. Is it good shit?
I'm saying I have never listened to it.
Well, see, that's something I was a topic, not specifically that his original band, but that's a topic that I was going to bring up later on in the show, is kind of my take and my relationship, because Pearl Jam, like we talked about offline, Pearl Jam first three albums, we're talking 10 versus Vitalogy. First three albums Pearl Jam is very different than post three albums Pearl Jam.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they're like a different band altogether.
Right. They're completely different.
They're progressing, you know, just like the Beatles, just like the Led Zeppelin, just like every band is going to progress, you know, mm-hmm. you know, through time.
Well, they had a little bit of a reverse like I feel like Pearl Jam, like they were trying to progress, but they were trying to progress as themselves versus Led Zeppelin, who was trying to progress to mass to take over the universe.
Right. Right.
You know what I'm saying? Pearl Jam was more like, okay, man, like they did the pseudo Nirvana thing. If Kurt wouldn't have died and Kurt would have continued doing, you know, songwriting and things like that and writing, if Nirvana would have continued writing albums, they would have, I feel like they would have traveled down similar paths as Pearl Jam.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Pearl Jam, like they're very, like, so when 10 came out, it was around the same time as when Nevermind came out. Right.
In
91, and they were both absolute box office breaking smash hit albums.
It wasn't, mm-hmm. didn't, you know, around the same time was that when Bad Motorfinger came out too?
Oh yeah.
It was same time as well as Jar, or not Jar Flies, but Dirt, or did Dirt come out?
Mm-hmm. Dirt. Yeah. It was
like the big grunge movement basically.
Well, Dirt didn't come out
until like what?
Until 94? Like, yeah, 95.
95, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, Bad Motorfinger was literally released 1 month after 10.
Boom, there you go. Makes about sense. And I'd say that's probably the heaviest record out of all three of them, if we're going to compare that, you know?
Heavy? Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
And the name the name of the album was Mookie Blaylock's jersey number, right? 10?
10.
That's where they got their original name, because Pearl Jam's original name, because like I said, when Eddie flew up
about
there,
for the album 10, just the name of the album 10.
Right. Yeah. That was the Mookie Blaylock's, their original band name. That was his number.
So fantastic.
Yeah. They moved very quickly after Eddie Vedder had moved up there. They started playing shows like 2 weeks after Eddie Vedder moved up there.
Boom.
And was doing stuff.
Love it.
Yeah, he joined a band. He joined the band after a week. They started calling themselves Mookie Blaylock, which is a player for the Chicago Bulls, and his jersey number happens to be the number 10. And so they started playing shows 2 weeks later. Something else to mention about Pearl Jam is they've kind of had a problem with drummers.
Yeah,
you could say that.
They've had a little bit of an issue with drummers. Dave Crewson was he was on the drums initially when they were still Mookie Blaylock. I mean, that was very short lived, but so anyway, yes. So Mookie Blaylock, you know, they're working on their album. They eventually signed with Epic Records, and that's when they renamed themselves Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
So they also, previous to this, they started opening up for Alice in Chains.
Cool.
They did that a lot on the Facelift tour.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
So that's kind of why they started. That's kind of where they started cruising, you know, getting a little bit of notoriety.
So for Pearl Jam's 10 album, Stone Gossard even said that, you know, he needed to find his own guitar without stealing it from other artists, because he supposedly a lot of the riffs and stuff that he was using, he just took it and put his own spin on it from like Jimi Hendrix and like Stevie Ray Vaughan type stuff. And then,
oh yeah,
because there's even certain songs that he actually stole the riff for Alive from Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you'll find that a lot, especially, I'm sure you've noticed, Mark, as a fellow guitar player, you'll notice a lot in Pearl Jam's, specifically their intros. They use a lot of Hendrix-y chords.
Mm-hmm.
They use a ton, like Yellow Ledbetter.
Mm-hmm.
The entire intro to Yellow Ledbetter is
Little Wing. Hendrix chord. It's like a Little Wing.
Yeah, exactly. So but anyway, like this album, Alive, this was a smash album, like we talked about. It was released August 27th, 1991. And I mean, just look at the songs that were on this album, you know, Even Flow, Alive, Black, Jeremy, Oceans, Porch, Garden, Deep, Release. Like those were all absolutely fantastic songs.
It's definitely one of my top 20 of all time favorite albums. Oh. Easily top 10, maybe.
Guaranteed, man.
It was a generational change. It was like moving the torch. It's like handing the torch off. And this is like one of the greatest albums of all time.
And it came out the perfect time. It came out right at the end of the spring, you know, and right before the summer. So like it was like the perfect time for that album to hit stores because everybody was just listening to that thing like nonstop 24 hours a day.
The whole summer. CD, I owned the tape.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I didn't even buy the tape. I was at the Seaside Heights Boardwalk in New Jersey, and I was at my buddy's stand where it's like this big wheel that you spin and you put down a quarter. So like you know you can win cigarettes, you can win tapes, CDs. That was before CDs, and that's where I got it, man. I was just like, I guess I'll try the new Pearl Jam. You know, I'll try those guys out, and then that fucking that thing must have stayed in my tape player in my car for like a month.
I think every one of my friends that I knew had this tape, dude. Everybody that I knew had this tape for.
Oh, everybody. Yeah.
It was everywhere. Same thing with Nevermind as well, man.
Oh yeah. I remember being hanging out with friends on a Friday night, and because it was before it was like when the single first came out, they didn't have the tape, wasn't in the store yet. So like we were all just hanging out, waiting for that stupid song to come on every fucking night, right, you know?
Oh man. And that's you don't see albums like that anymore. Like and speaking of anymore, like there's not too many of those albums out.
I won't disagree.
Yeah,
but the entire album is just absolute fucking gold. No filler songs.
Exactly.
No bullshit. Mm-hmm. The entire album is gold. Like I feel like Dark Side of the Moon's one.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, of course.
You know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Maybe Zeppelin's House of the Holy or Led Zeppelin 2, maybe.
Well.
But not on the same caliber, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Like, you know. And so here we go with our first drummer change. Krewson left the band in May of 1991 after checking himself in rehab, who he's replaced by Matt Chamberlain. And Matt Chamberlain only played a handful of shows with him. One of which was the Alive video. He was the drummer for the Alive video, but he eventually left the band and he went to go join the Saturday Night Live band.
Well, I mean,
what a fucking mistake.
It's a mistake, but at the time he was probably thinking, do I want to stick around with these rock and roll dudes or do I want to just live in New York and be, you know, in the Saturday Night Live band? I mean, that is such an honor to be, you know, asked to do.
Yeah, disagree.
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, especially during that time. Now, I don't think Saturday Night Live is as big as it was, but back then, that was one of the staple programs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, and then so Chamberlain, he got replaced by one of my favorite Pearl Jam drummers, Dave Abruzzese. How do you pronounce that? I've never been able to pronounce that guy. Dave A. Abruzzese, Aphrodisiac. I don't know.
Abruzzese.
Whatever. Pearl Jam fanatics, jump out of your chair and turn this podcast off right now. You know. But anyway, we'll call him Dave A.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For the sake of argument, he signed up with those guys and then he started playing the support shows and the tours with you know supporting 10, which that album once again absolutely blew me away. You know, it's gone 13 times platinum. So so after this was their Nevermind. So you know, we talked about the Nevermind effect, you know, that it had on Nirvana the last episode. It shot them from no go to turbo overnight.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, after that all they did was tour. And that's another thing to mention with Nirvana. Kurt Cobain in the very beginning did not like Eddie Vedder.
Yeah.
Openly talked about it. And there's a lot of interviews where you can see like when they're talking to Cobain, they'll ask him about Vedder and they're talking to Vedder, they'll ask him about Cobain. And Vedder has always been a very mellow, kind of chilled out guy. He never really says anything negative about Kurt. He's mostly in the realm of like, I don't understand why this guy doesn't like me.
Yeah, so, I've never done anything to him.
I've never done anything to him, man. Like, you know, Eddie always, and he's big got deal. This persona.
Big deal. He lent me one of his flannel shirts one night. I didn't give it back. Oh, fucking well.
Yeah, he's got to have 700 of them. Yeah. You know, no, and that's kind of a quote to Eddie Vedder's persona as well, because he's always got this kind of deep brooding, you know, kind of persona to him. You know, the Eddie Vedder persona, if you will. So anyway, after Tim was released, they did some appearances on Saturday Night Live and MTV, obviously. They did the MTV Unplugged. which was awesome, and also an incredibly difficult to find record.
Same thing with Stevie Ray Vaughan, man.
Oh my God!
MTV would release that. Actually, it is incredibly hard. Isn't that where he wrote on himself? What did he write on himself?
Oh, it was something to do with abortion, like free, you know, mind or whatever. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And he was also very politically activist. Yeah,
I remember watching it. He drew something on him with a Sharpie or something. I just can't remember what it was.
It had something to do with abortion.
Corporate magazines suck.
I think abortion rights or something.
Yeah.
I think it was pro-choice is what he was writing or something like that.
Yeah. But something
like that. We're getting ready to head into my favorite album.
Oh, shortly. You know, after they also did a couple of the songs for the 1992 Cameron Crowe film Singles, which we all know and love. If you guys haven't seen that movie, it's a great homage to 90s society and 90s basically. Music. You know what I mean? So they head into the studio after touring for 2 years in support of 10. They head into the studio in 1993, and they released their second album on October 19th, 1993, which is Verses.
I love it.
Which sold 950,000 copies in its first week.
Is that all?
Wow. I mean, shit, man.
That's dope. That album, such a great follow-up, too. Stuck with the same melodies, kind of stuck with the same chords, kind of maybe got a little heavier, a little faster.
It was a little heavier, right. Eddie was a little bit more raw on his vocals.
Yeah, dude.
Well, I think this, you know, an homage to this as well, because with 10, Eddie was kind of still semi new to the band, so he didn't really have his legs underneath him yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so at this point in time, Jeff and Stone are still very much the songwriters. You know what I mean? And I think in Verses, this is when Eddie kind of found himself and when Eddie began taking the reins on the songwriting.
Yes, he says, I have something to say and I'm going to say it.
Not
that you guys can't add stuff in, but I'm mainly taking over. This is my area now. Yeah.
Well, with that too, being that how famous, you know, such as after Nevermind, being that how famous they were after 10, Eddie is now in the spotlight, you know, and Stone and Jeff, which I kind of feel bad. And then I guess at the time, Dave, they kind of were just those supporting guys behind Eddie Vedder.
Oh, I can't disagree.
But that's how it goes with every band, though. I mean, honestly, I mean, unless you're Kiss.
I really can't disagree with Mark as well. Yeah. It's like now Eddie Vedder's got his feet wet.
True.
And it's and now it's going, dude. This album is just, then the way it starts, and then you got Animal Daughter, which is what their first radio hit off that album, if I do believe.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Then you got Glorified G, Dissident, which is a really slow, good song.
Dissident's
dude.
Great.
And just the whole album is really, really good. And it's just a great
song. Animal's a great, great, great song.
It's kind of like, I know, Mark, you're not like a Steely Dan fan, but it's like, Steely Dan came out with Asia, and then the next following album was Gaucho. And it's just a great follow-up album, kind of like with Red Hot Chili Peppers, with Blood Sugar Sex Magik to One Hot Minute, you know? Like, any other albums you guys could sit and say that are kind of like that?
Well, I mean, there was a whole slew of those in the 90s. I mean, you look at the bands in the 90s, I mean, it's just follow-up album after follow-up album. It's just they were killing it, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I mean, not that I'd like them that much, but Green Day was a great example. I mean, the follow up
for
Dookie, you know, was a great follow up.
What was that?
I forget
was
the name of the album, but I think so.
Yeah. Nimrod. Yeah, and so and that's another thing too is with this album. So with the first album, 10, they did they were getting deep into the music videos.
Yeah, true.
You know what I mean? Like they were getting music videoed to death.
Well,
like,
dude, everybody was during those times.
That's what I mean, because they were following up with the, you know, the music video boom of the 80s.
Not only
but
all these bands were on tour for these summer festivals, specifically Lollapalooza. I mean,
right?
Because I remember I went to the 92 Lollapalooza. That's where I touched Eddie Vedder's freaking foot when he jumped off the damn rafters on the stage. I mean,
wow!
Everybody who's anybody was going to be on tour at a festival that year,
specifically. Oh, for sure.
For all of the 90s, I would say, yeah.
For sure. And this is also too, because after putting out these, you know, like the music video for Alive, and how many times did you see Jeremy on TV?
Oh, God, dude, I was so sick of that song. I was so sick of that song.
Yeah, man. And you know, Eddie Vedder being the child star that he was a child star. He did great in the acting in that. And he also did great on the Temple of the Dog record, too. He made his first cameo there on Hunger Strike. That was good, too. I just had to mention that before I forget about it. But so with
At
Versus,
home,
they kind of put...
Strong picture.
Yeah, exactly. Mountain tall. Exactly. So they
Don't
started
you
to put
exactly
the kibosh
me
on that.
When I was singing?
I'm playing with your wax pile in the studio right now.
Nice.
So they put the kibosh on this music video bullshit, because Eddie was just not about it. They're like, we are not going to be known as a fucking music video band. Like, because once you get stuck in a rut like that, it's kind of like an actor. You know what I mean? Like what Marvel did with Iron Man. Nobody else in the history of fucking the universe can ever be Iron Man now.
Right,
ever.
Right.
You know, and so they didn't want to be noticed as
so
that. They didn't want to be
They started
as
doing what, more live videos, right?
Well, they started recording their concerts, and like we were talking about offline, they started putting out these bootleg copies. So if you really count them up, Pearl Jam has almost 72 yeah. live albums, right? Because they were recording every one of their shows, and these bootlegs were coming out.
And the bootlegs were super – they were so yeah. expensive back in those days. $30 for a CD for a bootleg concert, that was unheard of. Like, what?
Well, that also explains, you know, that goes into how big Pearl Jam was, because somebody was buying it.
Oh, everybody was buying them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, I bet you some of those things are probably worth some money.
I've got a lot of them. I'll tell you that.
I mean, the only other band you could really compare that to would be the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
With the live bootlegs.
Yeah.
Or Fish, yeah. Yeah. Jam bands.
Yeah, jam bands. And they also, during this tour, like their Versus tour, this is when they started kind of, because everybody knows, well, maybe not everybody knows, but people who listen to, you know, Pearl Jam fairly intently know of the big battle that they went through with Ticketmaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pearl Jam's always kind of been like a fight the system, you know, Rage Against the Machine type band in that aspect, not necessarily in their lyrics and their songwriting, but in their attitude towards performing and their fandom as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so during this tour, they also started setting caps on ticket prices, you know, to fuck with scalpers, because they wanted their music to be accessible to their fans.
Right.
And what Ticketmaster, you know, the monopoly that Ticketmaster is, what they were doing is the same shit that StubHub and everybody does now in Live Nation and shit, is, you know, you have a $30 ticket with $15, $20 worth of surcharge fees, which is almost 50% of the ticket price, in fees tacked on the back. And for what?
Not for pleasure, that's for sure.
I just
bought tickets for Rage about a month ago. And it cost me $620 to buy four of them. Three ticket math.
Wow.
Hey, can I ask a serious question?
Sure.
Do you guys think that there's ever going to be like concerts again?
Yes.
Concerts again?
Yeah. I mean, mass groups getting together with all this crap going on right now.
Oh, good Lord. This isn't the end of the world.
I don't know, man.
Well, don't spit in each other's mouths. You know, just be conscious of what you're doing. This whole quarantine thing, this has got me delved into my music. I feel like I've been in my back.
They're talking about this. I'm not going to get, you're right. I'm not even going to talk about that. But I was just thinking that the other day. Like, I mean, at least this summer, they're not going to have any concerts. I can guarantee you that.
What I want to know is how many babies are going to be born after this coronavirus.
Well.
Everybody trapped at home. There's a couple things you're going to be doing. You're going to be boozing and you're going to be boning.
I've been boozing, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and after this episode, you're going to be listening to Pearl Jam records while you're boozing and while you're boning. So anyway,
I haven't been doing either of those things, but
well, you are now. So after Versus comes out, they start setting ticket price caps on their, you know, to kind of get rid of scalpers, and they also start going after Ticketmaster. They were starting to not play Ticketmaster shows. They were, you know, essentially. You know, banning them from their tours. They weren't going to play Ticketmaster venues because they didn't want their fans to have to play these ridiculous surcharges. And they also filed a Supreme Court case against Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
To try to have them shut down at least change their policies.
That was so big that when they did that, it was like a whole world was watching Eddie Vedder in court that day.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so, but I don't know, because this also, when they were doing that, because everybody was touring, because they were one of the only bands that were going to do that. I think they were the only band that did that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was making it increasingly more difficult to see Pearl Jam play.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think what they were also doing with during those days too is they were selling reduced merchandise too, reduced.
Yeah.
You know, pricing on that stuff.
Yeah, and with the Ticketmaster thing as well, is it was making counterfeiters. It was making it easier for counterfeiters to make tickets and counterfeit tickets.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so it was difficult. So all this is going on. They're on tour with Versus. So they're very busy at this time. And in between, you know, live shows and court appearances and fighting the man, they're writing songs for their third studio,
which is another
album,
one of my favorite albums by this band. It's
another great album. I mean,
this is where they start getting a little dark.
Pushing these things out.
A little darker, and it's just so good.
Yep.
Yeah, and this is also where Dave A., he was fired from the band for creative differences and replaced by the Red Hot Chili Peppers former drummer Jack Irons.
How does a drummer have creative differences? You either play the drums or you don't, dude.
I mean, I don't know, man. I'm not too deep into the song creative writing process, so I don't know. I feel like at least back then, maybe each group had their songwriter, you know, their primary songwriter.
Yeah, usually it was a lead singer or the guitar player. I mean,
yeah, Jerry Cantrell wrote for Alice in Chains and Kurt for Nirvana, and now Eddie for, you know, but this is, like I said, this is starting to become Eddie's band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was also starting a lot of tension between them as well.
I mean, I never heard about any tension per se between like the main three.
Oh, there was, for sure. Absolutely. They were with Vitalogy. They were, I think this is actually No Code. They actually started recording No Code without Jeff Ament. And Jeff caught wind of it and got furious.
I bought that No Code CD. It was so weird because I think they actually had like four or five different versions of that album, if I'm serving myself correctly, because they had pictures inside the leaflet there on that one. A couple buddies of mine had different albums of it, and all their pictures were different, but some of them were same, but a couple were different. So it was kind of weird how they packaged that CD.
Yeah, Pearl Jam with their different. Yeah, Pearl Jam with their odd, like you were saying, like the cardboard cutouts of the albums and things like that. With their art, like odd presentation of their albums, they were just made to fuck up people's CD racks.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
I know. Like, I hated that album.
Vitalogy was an odd record. Just if you were talking about the packaging, just because it was all paper as well, and it was so weird.
That's
what
I mean.
It does, and it fucked up your CD rack, dude. I'll tell you that. You're all right.
Yeah.
Maybe they did that on purpose, because that's like that one giant encyclopedia in a row of paperback books.
Exactly. You're right. You're like, hey, honey, what do you listen to? I don't know. Let me look. How about Vitalogy?
Yeah. What's the tomb of ancient Egypt over there? Grab that out. Oh, it's Vitalogy. Let's listen to this. You know, so Vitalogy, their third studio album that was released November 22nd, 1994 on vinyl first.
It's so badass.
And then 2 weeks later on December 6th. On CD and cassette. Yeah, Eddie was all into the vinyl, and they even have that what's that song? Turn the Black Circle. Yeah, right. So they were always
or
big.
Spin
even
the black circle,
you know,
yeah.
You can see interviews with Eddie where he's Spin the Black Circle. Yeah. That was actually on Vitalogy, song too. So they were big into that. They always wanted to have their shit on vinyl. Make it, you know, and that song "Spin the Black Circle" was an obvious homage to vinyl records, and won a Grammy in '96. So, that's pretty good. So Vitalogy, let's talk about that a little bit. This is when we're still in the first three albums, I think, for Pearl Jam. I wouldn't call them the main. I feel like this is when their main following. They were huge at this point. They were at the peak of their game at Vitalogy, and after this, they kind of take a little bit of a dip
so
in popularity. I feel like. You know, they always have their
cut. I would say I kind of stopped after Vitalogy. I was kind of like,
Yield.
I'll go see.
I stopped after Yield.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever even bought Yield.
Well, Vitalogy in and of itself, that was a pretty, I mean, it wasn't chock full of powerhouse hits like 10 was, but I think that that's where that's the direction they were trying to go, is because they were, like I said in the beginning, if Nirvana would have continued, they would have followed the same track, because they didn't want the notoriety in the sense of, you know, like music videos and corporate notoriety. They wanted notoriety in the sense that they wanted their fans.
I think Vitalogy to me was like a story. You know what I'm saying? Like, you start off with the first track.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, it basically builds you up to Spin the Black Circle. And then it goes hard with Not For You, and, you know, kind of weird with Tremor Cries, but then Nothing Man. And then Corduroy. I mean, Bugs was a great song, kind of like Rats to the verses. And then Better Man, you know, so
right.
It kind of flows perfectly. And then you end with end with Immortality. It's just, this is great all the way. Great listen.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, they had that final song, that weird one, Hey Foxy Mama, Nama, Mop Handle Mama, you know, stupid mop, that weird song. But like I said, I think in order for a band to get huge, your album has to appeal to not only, you know, your niche audience, but it has to appeal. There has to be like 8-year-olds listening to your songs.
No, but but like 13 to 17-year-olds at least.
Well, I think back then everybody in the entire world was listening to Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
Everybody was listening to Pearl Jam, because that's not so much prevalent anymore, because albums aren't shaking, specifically rock albums aren't shaping the universe. But look at like artists like Taylor Swift. Like, you've got women in their 40s listening to Taylor Swift, and on the same, you know, in the same car, you've got a 7-year-old jamming out to it. So if you want to gain worldwide notoriety like Pearl Jam did and Nirvana did and all this kind of stuff, then you've got to apply to all audiences. And I think Vitalogy is when Pearl Jam started splitting off even more, you know, from their cliche corporate audience. Like, even like, listen to the song, the third track on the album, Not For You.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a blatant stab at that in and of itself, corporate cock stars, you know what I mean? Not rock stars, but cock stars. That's what they called them. You know, I think that's a blatant stab at that. Personally, and this is when they started, Pearl Jam started splitting off from those audiences, the corporate rock stars, and they started appealing to the Pearl Jam fans.
Which was probably like early 20s to about 40.
I think you're right. We're going right after Vitalogy to the next album, which is what? I think No Code. Then I think they start defining
No Code
as a different kind of band. They start sounding different and more jam bandish.
Yeah.
Yeah, more absolutely. More classic rockish than new rock. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think this is them getting back to their sound. You know, them realigning. And like I said, I honestly believe that Nirvana would have done this had they continued. Had Kurt not died, I feel like it would have gone from In Utero back to shit like Bleach.
That'd be fucking great. We'll never know. Yeah. That'd be fun.
We'll never know. But I think that's what. So with this, you know, also with Vitalogy, this is when they're in the heat of the Ticketmaster boycott. They're not touring a whole lot like they did with 10 and Versus.
Yeah.
They're not too, because it's hard for them to play anywhere because Ticketmaster's taken over
the
world.
What was the album where the fans got crushed to death in the front of the stage?
Oh, that was the Rock Slide Festival in 2000.
Well, they stopped touring after that.
That was after Binaural.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that was after Binaural. That was their sixth album.
Yeah.
That started going down. But yeah, so with No Code, like I said, it was released in 96. Not a whole lot of touring went. It was a great album.
Yeah.
You know, I loved No Code. Not as notorious as any of the other ones. You know, Red Mosquito, Off He Goes. Those are all really great songs, but there's no real smash hits on this album.
Yellow
something. I forget the name of the song.
What's that?
There's one of the albums where they did it. Riot Act had a couple good songs on it. Love Boat Captain. A couple other songs, man. But this is also where I also found out of a great compilation album that they have.
That's
called
No Fucking. You're thinking of Riot Act.
It's a great, great album.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
I would check it out.
Yeah.
Love Boat Captain. Love Boat Captain is off of Riot Act.
Is it?
It is.
That's a great song. So So we're going from No Code, and we're going to go to their fifth album, Yield, which was released February 3rd, 1998. It was, like I said, at this point, they're back to their straightforward rock and roll sound.
Do the Evolution was pretty much the only one that was popular. Only the only single they really put out for it.
Given to Fly was pretty.
Can I off some of these tracks off this album they released? It's called No Fucking Messiah.
Absolutely.
And it starts off with Not For You, Rearview Mirror, Daughter, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, Angel, I've Got a Feeling, Alone, Better Man, Already in Love, Crazy Mary, which is another track we didn't mention, 3 Days, Small Town, I Won't Back Down, Wash, Alive, Black, and then ends it with Porch. And it's just a great, great album.
That would be a great album, man.
That's fantastic.
Another song we didn't mention is Rearview Mirror off the single soundtrack. That was a great song.
Yeah. I think at this time, like I said, at this time, they are in full backpedal mode. They're doing Pearl Jam. They're not making albums to, they're not making albums to appeal to the corporate audience, to the 8-year-olds. They don't want their CDs in every single CD player. They're appealing to their audience and their fans, Pearl Jam fans.
I think that they're just playing the music that they'd love to play. And that's
absolutely that's what I mean, and that's what people love.
I guess they're trying to appeal to a fan base, I guess. But if I was at that popularity level, I'm playing what I want to play. I don't care if anybody listens to it or not.
And that's where they're exactly where they're at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that is exactly the mindset that they're at this point. They're you know, fighting corporate, you know, ticket sales. They're fighting scalpers. They're like they backpedaled away from the music video audience. They're still a very, very popular band. Don't make any mistake. They didn't just go into the caves or something. You know, they're still an incredibly popular band.
Oh, they're selling out multiple nights in every city.
Absolutely. And an homage to that Do the Evolution song. That's a fantastic song. And Todd McFarlane, if you've ever seen the video for that, Todd McFarlane did a lot of the animated video stuff for that. You know, and if anybody knows Todd McFarlane, he did the Spawn series.
Yeah, he was. That's a great song.
Absolutely, that's a great song.
Yeah.
So we're into, like you had mentioned, the Rockslide Festival. May 16th, 2000, they released their sixth studio album, Binaural. And this is a former Soundgarden drummer Matt Cameron's studio recording debut with the band. Because obviously, Soundgarden broke up, so Matt Cameron started going, you know, Chris Cornell went to audio, started doing stuff with Audioslave and solo stuff. I mean, there's a little bit of a timeline there, but Matt Cameron went off to join because Jack Irons, he couldn't handle the heat. He didn't want to deal with it. He didn't want to deal with the fame. He didn't want to deal with the constant touring. He wanted to surf. He wanted to be with his family. And so Jack Irons split off. Matt Cameron came in. And their sixth studio album in 2000, that's Binaural. That's when Soundgarden's Matt Cameron came in. And so this is kind of a transition too. Let's think about what was going on in music history in early 2000s. What kind of bands were starting to surface then?
Chumbawamba.
Chumbawamba. Yeah. Yeah. So you had the change in the tide from the 90s grunge movement. You know, people were sick of the grunge thing. The grunge thing was out. Now it was the
poppy,
you know,
bullshit.
For absolutely, the Sum 41s and the Blinks and all this kind of stuff is starting to surface in the early 2000s. Maybe not as early as 2000s, but in the early 2000s, the tide of music, rock and roll specifically,
Limp Bizkit
is starting to change. Limp Bizkit, that's right, absolutely.
That's right.
And so, in support of the Binaural album, in 2000 on their European leg of their tour on June 30th, there was the Rockslide Festival in Denmark, where 9 fans were crushed to death as the crowd rushed the front gate and rushed the stage while Pearl Jam was playing. Pearl Jam had consistently tried to stop that show and said, "Hey man, y'all chill out. You know what I mean? Y'all relax, stop trying to push to the front." And so they'd keep playing, then they'd stop again. And so finally, the entire crowd rushed. Yeah. And crushed 9 people to death. And that really, really had a lasting effect on the band, you know, specifically Eddie.
Yeah,
Vedder.
They feel responsible that those people died coming to see them, you know?
Yeah.
But that's not, it wasn't absolutely their fault, man. It was just the people and the security probably didn't take the proper, you know, steps. I mean, who knows what happened? People were, you know, it was like almost like Beatles mania when it comes to being in the front row for a Pearl Jam concert, you know? People are psycho up when they're up front.
Absolutely. And so they stopped touring for a year after that and started working on their seventh album, Riot Act, which we talked about a little bit ago, which was released November 12th, 2002. That album to me was really experimental for Pearl Jam.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was a definite, like almost folkier sound, I think, to Pearl Jam than what I was used to. Did you pick up on that a little bit, Drew?
And that's where they came out with Riot Act. They didn't come out with an album for a little bit. You know what I'm saying? So got to listen to it. I had high expectations for it, and it wasn't what I was wanting to hear from Pearl Jam. A lot of people were like, this is old Pearl Jam. This is what it's going to be. And I listened to it, and I was not moved by it. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that wasn't one of my favorite albums. I can tell you that.
For sure. I remember listening to through once. And I was like, next.
Yeah, but like I said, you know, it was still appealing to the Pearl Jam fan base because still at the time, you know, they're not underground at this point. You know, they're not Poison. You know, they didn't dive under a landfill.
Pearl Jam fans
don't care.
I mean, freak, Eddie Vedder can go up on stage by himself with a ukulele and they'll still love that shit. Oh, wait, he does that.
I was going to say, man, I actually, you know, I'm a first five, first four albums Pearl Jam.
Absolutely.
That's where I'm at.
I'm kind of with you. Yeah.
I love Pearl Jam, but I'm a first four or five album Pearl Jam fan as opposed to the entire discography fan. Now, that's saying that. I'm a huge Eddie Vedder solo artist fan.
He does have a lot of good songs.
I love, dude, that Into the Wild soundtrack. If you guys have never seen the movie Into the Wild, you should watch it. And Eddie Vedder does the entire soundtrack to the movie.
Well, Just Breathe is one of his. Was on his last album for Pearl Jam as well as his solo stuff. So I don't know.
Well, that was on Just Breathe was on Backspacer.
Yeah, but he does that on his solo stuff too, doesn't he? Just Breathe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he does different variations of that.
To me, like, that song right there is classic Pearl Jam, you know.
Kind
of
almost went back to 10 on that one
too.
Oh, they were absolutely.
Before they,
that's a good point.
They started out with Neil Young.
Yeah, that's when they started out, but they continued to do a lot of stuff with Neil Young. Like Neil Young was always a big Pearl Jam fan and vice versa.
Yeah, but you know what? When they were nobodies and they did some stuff on a Neil Young record for Neil Young, he didn't give him any credit.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of dickish, Neil.
Yeah, well.
I hope you hear this, Neil. That was a dick move.
Yeah.
Man, don't do that stuff, man. So their A Studio album released May 2nd, 2006, which is a self-titled album, Pearl Jam. That was decent. That was another, like I said, it appeals to a certain crowd. It appeals to they're in the full swing of we're going to appeal to Pearl Jam fans. Worldwide Suicide, Life Wasted. Those are great couple songs. But then, like I said, Eddie was doing a lot of his solo stuff. Jeff Ament did a lot of his solo stuff. And Stone Gossard was kind of just like on a peace mission or something. I don't know exactly what he was doing. But now, did you guys ever hear the 2007 Pearl Jam recording Love Rain Over Me from The Who?
Nope.
Wow, dude. That's a little homework for you. Go listen to Pearl Jam's rendition of The Who's Love Rain Over Me. That was they recorded that song for a film called Rain Over Me with Adam Sandler in it, a Mike Binder film in 07. That was I actually really, really, really like that rendition of it. Eddie Vedder just fucking goes hard in that song. It's pretty
good. Check it out.
So after this, before Backspacer, their ninth studio album, they did a lot of touring, a lot of European touring, a lot of Lollapaloozas they're back to in the big concerts because they kind of gave up with the Ticketmaster thing. They're like, well, you know what? If we're not playing with Ticketmaster, we're not playing with fucking anybody, so we might as well just do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So they released Backspacer September 20th, 2009. That was a pretty good record as well. Like I said, not my favorite. Just Breathe, that was fantastic. The Fixer, Amongst the Waves, Johnny Guitar, those are all really, really good.
Yeah, Amongst the Waves is good. I like that one.
Yeah, that's all good stuff. So, you know, we're going to move forward with them a little bit. And then their 10th studio album? Lightning Bolt?
Mm-hmm.
That was a good one. Your typical Pearl Jam stuff. Released October 15th, 2013. That was a typical Pearl Jam album. It was great. And they actually have their 11th studio album, Gigaton,
It is.
I think it's coming out next week.
Hmm.
March 27th, 20.
Yep.
Cool.
Is that when it's coming out?
I mean, it's probably, wow. I get a chance to far see them live. It's like one of my bucket lists. I've never seen Pearl Jam live. So.
Oh, dude, I've seen
it.
I've probably seen them at least nine times.
Wow, that's awesome, dude. I'm jealous.
They were everywhere. They were everywhere. Yep. For many, many, many years.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great live.
I saw them one time, and I think it was in like 2015. It was here in Jacksonville, and I was so drunk that I barely remember it.
Mm-hmm.
So I always tell my wife, Kristen, that Pearl Jam's pretty much the only – because I don't know if any of you guys out there have noticed this, but the trend of concerts, much like everything else in the world, you almost can't afford to go anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you remember back in the 90s and early 2000s, it would be like, oh, man, fucking Stone Temple Pilots is coming into town. General admission tickets are only $25.
For the Sanitarium Tour.
Let's go check them out.
It had Korn, Metallica, Korn, Kid Rock, Papa Roach, System of a Down, and somebody else. And it was the highest ticket I've ever paid for. I think it was like $120. And I think the other highest that I ever paid for was Nine Inch Nails and Perfect Circle opened up for them. I think that was like $90. I literally just bought two tickets to Tool and spent almost $350.
Dude, that's the thing, man. Like with modern day, and I kind of get it because we're going through that weird transition that the 2000s went into with like streaming music. You know, when streaming music kind of started killing CDs.
Yep.
You know, when the iPods were the first edition iPods.
They're raping us on the live charges.
That's it. Yeah,
that
exactly.
makes perfect sense there, Will. Perfect sense, though. They're flooding us up with the freaking live charges, man.
Well, because that's where they're making their money, because nobody's buying albums anymore. You pay Pandora Premium for $10 a month, you got every album in the fucking world.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not, you know, you're not going to FYE in the mall anymore or whatever and Best Buy and you know, buying their $15, $20 new album. They're getting all their money in the back end and touring charges.
Mm-hmm. Anymore. I mean, barely they have a selection there for you to buy anymore.
Well, because nobody sells them anymore. And so what they're doing is they're making money on merch, number one. They're making money on ticket prices, number two. And then you have what the very thing that Pearl Jam and Eddie Vedder were trying to fight is these surcharges. For instance, Mark and I were trying to go see the Rack and Tours not too long ago. And I was like, oh, Rack and Tours, that won't be too bad. You know, decent tickets were $120 with $30 worth of fees. And I'm like, dude, they're not a $150 band.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not paying that. Like, I'd pay $50. But they're not a $150 band. And there's another thing, too, that's kind of weird. You remember back in the day with shows, nobody wanted the general admission tickets were the cheap tickets.
Yep.
The standing room tickets were like the cheap ones. You know, those were the $30, and then the seating started at $60 or $50 or $40, whatever. Now the general admission tickets are the expensive ones.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, general admission will be $120, and seats will be $60.
Exactly.
Was $500.
That's what I'm saying, man, and I just can't. What I was leading to is Pearl Jam is the last band on this earth that I will pay whatever it costs to sit front row.
Hmm.
I don't care if it's $1,000, I'll pay it. I don't care. So I think that's going to wrap it up. Pearl Jam, like we were talking about a little bit like I was talking about with Mark, Drew, before you got on the line, is I think you always ask, Drew, is what is the best American rock band of all time, American rock band now, not rock band, American rock band. And I think Pearl Jam is dangerously close in that category because, one, they're one of the longest lasting American rock bands of all time. And two, they've stayed together, like I said, longest lasting. And three, they're absolutely, completely, and utterly notorious.
What about Motley Crue?
No.
I can't disagree with you upon that, dude.
No.
Poison.
Vince.
That can even remotely come close to that is Aerosmith, dude. American rock band.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there you go.
There is not many.
Absolutely, but there's not many.
Yep.
There's not many. Probably I can count them on one hand. But anyway, guys, sorry for the delay in the most recent episode here. We're obviously all locked down in our homes. I'm hoping that we are providing you with at least some form of fucking entertainment here with this Pearl Jam podcast. We will be back with you as soon as we can. And we love you.
Right.
Take care, guys.